is Going Up Alleys, a podcast, episode 2, Composer Decomposer. Welcome to the Going Up Alleys podcast. We have two hosts today, or maybe host and guest. We'll see how this goes. I'm Steve Sekula, and this is Kate Sekula.
Word.
You may have noticed we're related. And I don't know, we have a couple of goals for this conversation. We'll try to enlighten one of our audience members about what might have happened, might or might not have happened at a recent conference on music.
Or if it happened at all.
Or if it happened at all. If it wasn't a clever ruse to just come down and borrow my house for the week.
Jet tub.
So, Kate, you are a doctoral student in music at the University of Connecticut.
Yes.
And you live in Oklahoma.
Yes.
Okay. But recently you attended a conference in Fort Worth. So what was that conference? Like, what's the topic? Why did you go? What did you see?
It was the Texas Society of Music Theory's annual conference. The main Society of Music Theory has many regional chapters. So this was the Texas chapter, which covers Texas and also Oklahoma. And I went down to see my friend Carissa give a talk and also to usurp your house and get away from Oklahoma for a weekend.
So what is music theory? Let's start there.
It is the analysis of how music is composed.
Okay. And so putting it in terms a non-musician can understand, what do you do? Like, if you're, okay, what's an average day for a music theorist like?
Waking up at noon,
drinking espresso,
and then going to a regular day job. And then any music analysis is taking various compositions, looking, well, how could have this been composed? How is it different from... You know, we're taught kind of basic archetypes for how a piece of music from a certain era is composed. Well, how is this similar? How is it different? And the area I'm in is 20th century British choral music, which tends to get into a lot of group theoretical and actually number principles.
Okay.
So each pitch can be numbered from 0 to 11. C, C sharp, D, D sharp, you know, so it'd be 0, 1, 2, 3. D sharp and E flat are the exact same thing, so they're always a 3 no matter how you come at it.
So it really doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. So it kind of creates a pitch equality. Mm-hmm. And then the way that you arrange those in the different permutations, so you can have, you know, the major triad is a 0-4-7. And then, okay, well, then how does that appear throughout this piece of music? Is it embedded in a larger set that happens to be like the master set for the piece of music? Or are there no triads, like normal tonal music would be normal? Okay. I can hear my advisor saying, no, it's not normal.
that's, we all hear the voice
that's
of our
not the word.
In
it's
our
not
heads.
Normal yes. Or versus abnormal. It's just different. So yeah, I use numbers.
Okay.
And different permutations of the numbers to try and figure out how it's put together.
So in a sense, numbers are like the little base pairs, and then you can construct them together into genes and sequences. And then if you have a piece of music, you can analyze it and look to see, well, does this have the genetic fingerprint of a certain style of music, a certain composer, even?
Yeah.
So you can even dig as deep as a composer.
Oh, yeah, easily, yeah. Theory. Well, and easily. And, you know, every composer has their kind of telltale markings. But the composer I'm interested in, Michael Tippett, the problem with the piece of music I'm trying to analyze, which is his Vision of St. Augustine, is that there is no real fingerprint on it. And what it ends
so
up
no
being...
So no one's ever been able to establish a fingerprint for Michael Tippett's this specific composition?
This specific composition. A lot of it, because it has to do with religion and it has to do with this Christian experience of the vision of eternity and the experience of God, it's been related a lot back to psychological aspects of it, relating it to Carl Jung and kind of the idea of timelessness and how timelessness is created in this piece of music. But no one's been able to go and say, okay, well, this section is composed in this exact manner and these are the musical pieces that are put together and this is exactly how it's created. And that's because he doesn't use just any one technique. He uses techniques that I call, they're of a pan-historical nature. So he's got techniques all the way dating back to, you know, chant. In fact, it's based on a chant. There's a chant that runs throughout, or a hymn that runs throughout it. All the way up through 20th century techniques. Because when you hear it, it doesn't sound like Beethoven. It doesn't sound pretty at all. Mm-hmm. It sounds like, what is going on here? So I find that, you know, there's multiple layers going on at any given time. There's a baritone solo, and that is just based on the text. And the rhythm of it is actually based on how you would speak Latin. So, and that's one of the things I want to do, is actually speak the Latin into a microphone and then change it over into durational notation and mm-hmm. see if that works with the baritone line of it. And then you'll have, like the violins, they're playing a G major scale. And you can go, that's a G major scale. And, you know, you look out onto the paper and it's just going up and down the scale. Okay. And the timpani's doing a C major triad. Dun, 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 dun. But all these things put together, it sounds like chaos. And I love it.
So each of the underlying parts is a totally reasonable piece of music.
Exactly.
But then when they're all layered on top of one another.
Right. And so my goal is to create the synthesis of all these, how did I put it? Well, all these varying techniques into one master analysis.
Michael Tippett. When did he live? When did he compose? When did he die?
So he was born early 1900s, and he actually died in 1999. So during 20th century.
Wow.
Yeah. His first real compositions were in the 20s. He was completely in love with Beethoven. They were very Beethoven-esque, and he gave his first performance, and you know, the reviews kind of said, "Well, that's great." You know, he set out to do what he wanted to do, and he kind of went, I'm going to scrap everything I've done so far. So those pieces are hard to find in publication, just because he, you know, he went, you know what, this is all crap. I'm going to start a new period. And so the music I'm most interested in is in the 1960s. So he likes to, well, as all composers do, they react to whatever is going on in the world. Mm-hmm. So the first reaction he had was actually earlier with the Kristallnacht.
All right, so could you explain the Kristallnacht? What is the Kristallnacht? Because I'm not familiar with that term.
Cut to Wikipedia.
So we totally look this up on Wikipedia.
We totally look this up on Wikipedia just because Kate got nervous and couldn't remember what it was.
Okay.
But it was the beginning of the final solution in Nazi Germany that started a bunch of attacks on Jews in Germany that... There was a lot of broken glass, so that's why they called it the Kristallnacht. All these beautiful windows in the churches were destroyed. And Michael Tippett was just appalled by this event. And so it made him create this piece called A Child of Our Time. And so this was a reactionary piece of music. And this was interesting because it was based on American Negro spirituals. So each movement is a different spiritual. And when you hear it, you don't, your ear doesn't go, oh, that sounds weird. It sounds not normal to my classical ear, you know, and the stuff, music I've been growing up on NPR. This seems perfectly normal. And it's probably one of his most performed pieces of music.
Because it's the most approachable.
It's the most approachable. But I'm looking at the 1960s, so we're kind of at Korean War, assassination of JFK, assassination of Martin Luther King, women's rights, and Cuban Missile Crisis. So all of this is going on in the early 1960s, and that's when this piece of music was created. And whether or not he was actually writing the piece of music as, you know, he never stated, like, I am reacting to the current political climate of the early 1960s.
So he didn't keep any records that suggest his state of mind as he was composing.
No. But I think he had a change in his compositional sound around this time. And it really started sounding much more, you know, quote unquote, modern. Right around the 1960s, started with an opera he wrote just before this with a lot of Jungian concepts of love, and it was called The Midsummer Marriage. And that, even though it wasn't well received at the time, about 10 years later, it was revived, and then people were like, oh, this is great, because the ears had acclimated to that kind of music.
Okay.
And so they could revisit it. And
so it was jarring at first, but then presumably so many other changes.
So much other stuff happened in music in that decade, yeah.
Okay. People were more accepting of it a decade later or less.
Yeah,
less than a
they understood
later.
It more.
Mm-hmm.
More had been published about it. But this, the vision of St. Augustine is so interesting to me because it's a religious topic. It's from Augustine's Confessions. He's one of the, you know, the founders of the Catholic Church. And Michael Tippett was very much an atheist. But he had always been drawn to this text, even since he was... like high school years, our American high school,
grade school.
And I find that interesting that he just decided to cite a text that was so deeply religious, and he was not at all. So there's a lot of what people have coined as being dualist nature in the piece of work. It's religious, but Tippett wasn't religious. It's trying to evoke this feeling of this vision of eternity. So he's trying to create this feeling of timelessness. Mm-hmm. But music is inherently based on time. It's got meter. It's got rhythm. An audience member sits down and goes, okay, the piece has started. And 45 minutes later, okay, the piece is over. You know, so trying to create... And that's where I feel the different layers of all these... musical concepts that are normal to us. G major scale. Okay. Are you familiar with coloratura?
No.
It's a really... Okay, so last night we went to see the U.S. Army Field Band perform. And they did portions from opera. And when the sopranos go really high and sing really, really flourishy...
Yeah.
Okay, so they'll take one word and then, you know, prolong the vowel and do all this like show off stuff on it. Okay. That's coloratura.
Okay.
Okay. So you'll have coloratura and the sopranos, you know, and there's repetitive things in it. You'll have melodies that are repeated or rhythms that are repeated, but they're all repeated at different rates. Nothing ever is like, okay, here's the block. And then it's repeated again. Mm-hmm. Everything's overlapped or he throws in rests. And so I think it's because of that, that you get that feeling of timelessness and that it's not easily approachable to a listener. But the best thing about it is at the very end, the choir speaks in whatever the native language is of where it's being performed. I count not myself to have apprehended. You know, what just happened? I don't know.
So it's very difficult to understand this piece just by...
A listener is going
to... Just by listening to it, by studying the composer's time period.
Yeah.
It just still doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and my favorite section of music is I can look at each different instrumental voice and go, this is what's going on here. Okay, I understand. And maybe they're not all related to each other. Okay, the tenors are in E flat. The sopranos are in G. The, you know, the violins are in, or the timpani's in C. They're all in different keys. But each line I can go, this is what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's all played together, it's a wall of sound. And you could never orally pick it out. I think it's so cool.
So how do you begin to make sense of it then? I mean, how do you deconstruct it and then reconstruct it?
First, it really started with the historical background. Trying to figure out his style periods. What is the main kind of characteristics of each style period, and then I can go, okay, well, this is in the 60s. This is kind of the third style period. This is, you know, dissident times in the world, and so you can kind of, you have to situate it historically first, and situate it historically in his biography. And then you have to look at what else has been written. And there's two major authors, David Clark and Arnold Whittall, and they've both done phenomenal previous work on it. But it's the kind of work, especially the David Clark, that takes several readings for you to go, ah, I finally understand this, because this is just the way I've approached it. I've been looking at this piece of music for years now. Mm-hmm. And I'm finally getting to the point where I'm going, oh, and I'm seeing relationships and going, you know what? It's really not all that hard to figure out. It's just because there's so much stuff going on at once.
Right. So did you attack it in pieces? Did you, for instance, take one part?
There's three parts to it. I'm only looking at the third part.
Oh, okay. Okay. But I mean, even within a part, where do you, if you delaminate it, that is, take the layers of the music apart and look at each layer, are you able to then say, ah, that's sort of in the vein of Beethoven or Bach?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
But then the question is, why or how is it stitched together in the way that it's stitched together to make something?
He creates what's called a moment form. Your life is lived moment to moment. This music is experienced moment to moment. And this technique was coined by Karl Stockhausen. I don't know if you've heard any. We can throw some audio clips at the end.
Yeah. Oh, no. I think we'll definitely have, all right, we'll fix this in post, and we'll have peppered this with audio clips.
So Karl Stockhausen created this idea of the musical form, you know, I'm drinking my coffee moment. And you know what, then I'm going to go out and get the paper, and that could be completely different music, but it's okay, because you're just following these series of moments. Then I'm going to have breakfast. Okay, that's another moment. So, and Tippett will delineate it. He has all these he has 13 different tempo markings, which I haven't quite figured out. All I know is that there's a tempo marking change, and there's also a textural change in the music. So it'll go from what's called monophonic, just kind of one line of music, and the soloist above it. And then there'll be a tempo change, and then there'll be, you know, three or four different strata going on. And then there'll be a bar line and a tempo change, but it's really just moment to moment. And it relates to the text. You know, the beginning, he's talking about he and his mother, Monica. They're at the port of Ostia, which is the crossing of the Mediterranean into Africa. And they're both looking out over the port of Ostia, and he's talking about, you know, this is right before she died. And then the next thought is, then we both had this vision of eternity, and this is what it felt like. And then part three is after that's happened. Mm-hmm. And he's looking back at it going, you know, what if we could suspend all other thoughts, all other visions, and just have this one, if everyone could experience this one pure moment of knowing what God is like, wouldn't that be the greatest joy? And each thing, like, he hits the word joy, new moment. It's very cool. Mm-hmm. So there's no, you can't go, this is a sonata form, or this is a double concerto, or okay, well, it's a cantata. So normally cantatas are broken up into a cantata is a piece of work for soloist and orchestra and choir, and you'll have the soloists sing their solos, and then the choir can respond, and the orchestra is accompanimental. And this is classified as a cantata, and that's about as far as you can go with the cantata thing. Like, oh, it's a cantata because it has these, you know, it's got a solo, it's got a choir, and it's got an orchestra.
Mm-hmm. It has the basic three elements that are required for a cantata, and right, beyond that, there's not much right more one can say.
So Bach wrote cantata, so it's very Bach-like in that respect.
Okay, in that one structural element.
Yeah.
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 Okay.
So it's just moment to moment. Music changes, new moment. Mm-hmm. Music changes, new moment. It's
awesome. So I assume that this is the piece that you're devoting your life to for your thesis.
Yes. Yes. Mm-hmm. And right now it's been about 25 measures for the past 6 months.
focusing on just 25 measures.
Yeah, but they're my favorite measures.
Do you have to go more than that?
Yeah, I would like to do the entire part.
You would like to do the entire part.
But the rest of it is not nearly as hard as these measures are. There's about 11 different layers, each doing its own thing. And it sounds like pure chaos, but when you break it down, you can easily go, oh, this is exactly what's going on in each layer. It's just when you hear it all together at once, your brain could not possibly sit there. You know, a listener couldn't, even an educated listener cannot just sit there and go, oh, I definitely hear the G major scale on the violins.
Right.
No.
So how does this connect to the music theory conference that you went to, or does it connect?
Not very much.
All right, so total left turn then.
A lot of the talks at the conference were about sonata theory. There was a text that came out a couple years ago, Elements of Sonata Theory by the authors are Darcy and Hepikoski. We call it the Darhep.
Okay.
And there were a lot of talks about, and that's what Carissa gave her talk on. They've really taken the concept of the sonata and given exact definitions for every aspect of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's different types, type one, type two, type three, but it's not something that I know of it. I've done some analysis with it, but you kind of get it. It's like physics, you know, you're not doing
plasma physics.
Yeah.
But plasma physics is interesting because it's physics.
And you know the basic concepts
right.
of it, but you're not going to go and publish on it.
Right.
Okay.
So it's toward breadth.
Yeah, yeah. And the other big concept right now is narrative, which is actually very, very exciting. There is one professor, his name is Michael Klein. He's out of Temple University. And he's done some great work with narrative in late Romantic music, like the music of Chopin. Like every piece of music, even if it doesn't have words, tells a story. And, you know, so it can be of a heroic nature. And does the main character win at the end or lose at the end? And whenever he gives a talk, he always relates it back to Lord of the Rings somehow. So he's always talking about Bilbo Baggins. And he's also one of the only music presenters I ever see who doesn't sit there and just read from his paper.
Mm-hmm. That's good.
He will get so excited about his material. He, you know, gets away from the podium and he runs over to the piano and he's playing stuff and getting excited and talking about Bilbo Baggins. And so it's always...
It's very engaging.
It's very engaging. And so this concept of narrative... actually, one of the best papers, was that on narrative? Yeah, the best graduate paper was on narrative. But the best thing about this conference was how much it focused on undergraduate music theory pedagogy.
Okay.
And I find that
Explain.
So refreshing.
So this is not something that... So when you're an undergraduate in a music program, you don't get access to pedagogy in music theory?
Wait, when you're an undergraduate?
Yes.
You mean when you're a graduate student teaching?
Well, I guess what were you referring to?
Okay, how to teach music theory.
Oh, how to teach.
Okay. To undergrads.
Okay, oh, okay.
And basically calling for a revolution in the way that it's taught. There, and I find this a lot now that schools are stuck in kind of the way I had it as an undergrad. Like, let's look at music history. We had exams that were basically drop the needle. That's what they're called.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to drop the needle on a record in a random place and you tell me what it is.
I see.
Okay. And it's not based on, it's just give me the piece of music, the composer and the date instead of the why.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what was so great about my comprehensive exams is that it's not about, I mean, sure, okay, if you get the right composer, fine. But if you tell me you think it's this, and then you tell me why, and your why makes sense, that's more important to me than
just getting the right
and answer. Just being able to identify pieces of music. Just, mm-hmm. I know that that's Berlioz, and I know that that was written in 1850.
Right.
And
because I've listened to enough Berlioz.
Because I've, basically. Well, because yeah. I've listened to this one piece of music over and over and over again because I knew it was going to be on the exam.
Okay.
That's how people forget.
Mm-hmm. So it's the same disease we have in teaching physics.
Where
the student always wants to know, well, which equation do I use to solve this problem? Well, you tell me, and then tell me why you chose the equation you chose.
Instead of just having, well, I've got this list of equations, and this is how I felt, you know, in high school physics. Okay, I have a list of equations. but which one do I use? And right. I don't know why.
Right, right.
There was another...
And the why matters a lot.
And the why matters a lot. And also the fact that getting students to make the connection between the fact that, okay, you go to a freshman theory course, and then you go to an ear training lab, and then you go to your private lesson, and they don't see it that all these things should be interconnected in their brain, okay? Mm-hmm. I'm going to music theory so that I can understand that, oh, when I'm playing this piece of music, oh, that's it. Oh, okay, I'm just playing scales here, and this is just, oh, and these are just arpeggios here, and it makes you understand the music more, so it's easier to learn, mm-hmm. okay? Because music is just patterns, and it's where the pattern breaks, that's where you mess up.
Right.
Okay. So having them trying to find the pattern, and then they can play it more musically. When the pattern changes, maybe I want to change something about the way I'm playing then, mm-hmm. or emphasize that note where the pattern changes. But I've taught classes where the students have reviewed me and said, oh, well, this is X class, and it should be only that topic, and I don't understand why you're trying to relate it to music theory, and when they should be making these cross connections.
Right.
One of the...
Well, so is it also a problem that teachers have over-compartmentalized the different aspects of music in the same way that in physics we over-compartmentalize the different aspects of physics? So this is electromagnetism, this is quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
And students think that you take one, you pass it, you're done with it, you go on to the next one, you pass that one.
Well, and also, an undergraduate student's brain may not be able... You go to college, you enroll in all these classes, you're taking all these classes, and you're trying to do well in all of them, and your brain doesn't have time to go, oh, this is all interrelated.
Right.
And, it's not till you teach it that you go, oh.
I should tell them that this is all interrelated.
This is all interrelated. No, because even if you tell them it's interrelated, they don't get it. They don't get it yet until they have that, oh, moment where they realize.
Yeah.
So that's the point of changing the way that you teach it, so that they have those moments. So instead of going, I'm going to teach you this concept, and here it is, I like rather going from the known to the unknown. So let's say I want to teach them a new chord, mm-hmm. and but they already know these three different chords. So okay, well, first I'll have them dictate, write down, I'll play the keyboard progression for them. And they'll write down the outer voices of that, and it'll seem really easy to them. Okay. And it's almost comical when I do this, because they're like, really? What are you getting at? And I said, now I'm going to add something new. And I want you to mark an X where you hear something different to your ear and why it was different. And then we'll figure out what it was. Mm-hmm. Instead of saying, this is a new chord here. This is how you do it. Okay. Now let's do some... Let's write it. Okay, that's great. Now let me play it for you. It's a discovery method is much better. Mm-hmm. And one of the cool facts that I learned at this conference was that it's really more of a recent thing in European conservatories that students take private lessons. Conservatories, it used to be that if you wanted to go to the Paris Conservatory, you went and you took academic classes. And that's what you did. And if you wanted private lessons, they go, oh, you want private lessons? Well, here's a list of recommended teachers. You can go do that in your own spare time. I think that's fantastic.
So classes and lessons completely separate from one another. And that lessons are on your own time.
And that was a conservatory.
Okay.
That's, the performance school. Mm-hmm. So, so getting back to the conference, lots of pedagogy. And the camaraderie in this group is just fantastic. There's no ego. Very close knit. Everyone gets along. And there is this one fantastic presentation on guitar repetitions in hardcore punk rock music. And it was actually by a guy who's at Oklahoma City University right now. And My friend Carissa made a really good point. She's taken like a class on the music of the Beatles. And the chord progressions and they try and over academize it. They're like, oh, that's the one chord, and then it goes to this, oh, how does it go to the other chord? Well, that's a parallel, That's the parallel relative transformation of the chord with a, you know, leading tone exchange. Then after that, when it's really just, okay, I have my hand position on the guitar. And you know what's easy? If I move up one fret. Mm-hmm. With the same hand position. Right. And that's what this guy was getting at. And we're like, yes, thank you for just... It's refreshing. Right. Yes, that's exactly
reason,
what it is.
The reason the music works so well is because it involves intelligent choices of movement.
It was a power chord. Yes, right. How to get from point A to point B. Yeah, that sounds good. Okay, let's go with that.
In the most musically effective way possible. Yeah.
So, and it was cool. He gave us little paper cutouts of guitar frets so that we could finger long.
Oh, okay, so you could actually see what he was pointing out, which is that it was, in fact, it makes sense that you go from here to here, because that only involves sliding up two frets.
Yes, here is the regular power chord and how it is built, and then, yeah, let's just slide that up and down the fretboard. The end.
Right.
Let's not make it more than it is. Which I think is my issue. I try to oversimplify things, and then I go, wait, I have nothing to write on. This is too easy.
Well, maybe that's why people over-academize things.
Yeah, I know,
to talk about.
Yeah. Okay, let's not talk about music theory anymore.
Okay.
All right, so I'm going to give you the update. Here we go. We're going. So this is the part of the podcast where we give you the Google alert for the word Sekula. All right, so I have a Google alert for Sekula Banovic. Whoever that is. And it says, useful informations for Sekula Banovic. We have millions of celebrity page, and Sekula Banovic is just one of them. There you go.
In case anyone was really
there you
out
go.
There Googling this last name.
Wanting to know.
Had to know.
And then the hilarity of my day when I read my daily horoscope. Smiling diffuses conflict. You may feel at odds with others today. I hate you, Steve.
It happens.
You might find that you have differing opinions and thoughts that could make your interactions more challenging, which I think is called life. Mm-hmm. This may be a good time to work on becoming patient and loving with yourself. Mm-hmm. As you become more harmonious with your feelings, you may find that there is turbulence in your interactions with others. You can then approach your communications in a more detached way.
So here are a few fun things to think about involving your horoscope.
Okay.
Try reading another horoscope regularly and
oh,
see
I know.
If you agree with it. Yeah, and you're familiar with what this is called, right?
Well, I don't know what it's called, but yeah, I've heard
so
of it.
So the general effect, the general psychological effect that
horoscopes...
It's like
placebo. You go, oh yeah, that's
well,
totally
yeah, it has a specific name. It's called the Forer effect. It's when you use general statements, but those general, you interpret those general statements as applying to you and to you alone.
Is that how psychics work sometimes?
Yes, yeah. It's exactly how... So you say something that probably applies to 75% of the people that are sitting in front of you. You have to know your audience first, right? So one of the techniques that, for instance, TV psychics will use when they're doing a reading in an audience is they'll say, I'm getting a name. It's kind of a J or a M or a P name. Well, J and M and P are some of the most common letters that names start with in the United States. So you're going to hit.
My uncle's name was Jamuppa.
Right. Now that would be
impressive.
That'd be
awesome.
That would be impressive. That would make me think that maybe this would be psychic. But these very general statements are known as Barnum statements, and in honor of P.T. Barnum, because their generality is obvious, but people interpret them as being specific to them. And so, you know, you could read another person's horoscope for a week or a month and get the same effect you're getting by reading your horoscope because it's so general. Well, of course it applies to me. Yep, delightful stuff.
Two thoughts come to mind. One, people are stupid. And two, you just over-academized that.
I did.
Yeah.
Well, you know, this is what happens when you teach a course in it. And I disagree. I don't think people are stupid. I think everyone recognizes that the world is a complicated place and they want to believe that you can look at the stars and the planets and by looking at where they are, know something about what your day is going to be like or what your life is going to be like. We want that, right? We want easy answers out of like simple things that you can go out and measure. But, you know, the history of astrology hasn't changed very much since it broke off with astronomy. And, you know, one of the things I enjoy about astrology is that it fails to take into account planetary and astronomical bodies that have just as much or more influence over like us gravitationally, but that nobody knew about in the ancient astrology.
Wow.
Like the asteroid belt.
The what belt?
The asteroid belt.
The what belt?
Earth and Mars. Stop.
It's a magical belt. It tells me what to do.
Yes. Apparently. All right.
So I get, this is a great segue into my job at the library.
Okay.
Because I get a lot of people who come in So let me back up.
Yeah, we should back up here.
I work at a public library.
We won't name which one.
We won't name which one. It's in the middle of nowhere, America. So I like to call it Awesomeville.
Okay.
I work at Awesomeville Public Library, or the APL.
Okay.
We had a lot of patrons coming in asking for astronomy books. And when I give them books on stars, and they go, no, I want my horoscope. And I go, oh, you mean astrology? Yeah, same difference. No. And all I can do is nod and smile.
Yeah. Now, astronomy is the study of heavenly bodies that has improved the quality of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
Astrology is nonsense that has not.
Yeah.
Well, it's been a lot of fun.
Word.
This is a nice second to inaugural episode of Going Up Alleys.
Second to inaugural?
Yeah, well, the inaugural was the last one where I just shamelessly used a public lecture to, you know.
Oh, I don't know. I never
listened to the podcast.
I never listened to your podcasts.
No one does. This is purely an exercise in sort of audio masturbation.
I'd like to take this moment
to give
a shout out to my fiance, JC. Oh, shout out.
We'll edit that out in post.
Shout out.
All right. Well, Kate, it's been delightful having you here.
Yay.
We'll do this
I wish
again.
I could see the same. Oh.
Thanks, everybody.
Word.
Bye.
You're awesome.
This has been Going Up Alleys, a podcast by Steven Sakura. Music was provided by Nikoko. The song is Occipital, from the album Classicoco, available for download on Jamendo.